Yeah.
Different time to take my drug, which doesn't affect me so much.
Okay, a call to order the House Committee on Business for on education. I almost said business and labor for the 22nd of February. Okay, thank you very much. We have two informational hearings today, one on Every Student Successful Succeeds Act, and then one on an informational hearing and update on House Bill 2016. So with that, I'll open an informational hearing on Every Student Succeeds Act. And I just want to note, Congresswoman Bonamici, who was very instrumental in Washington in putting this together, she was here the other day when House went rather long, and she couldn't go, and then she had to leave. She was going to come today, but, you know, it was unsure as to how long our floor would last, and she had to leave at 1:30. So hopefully we'll have her back because she was there on the ground with it. So with that, I would like to bring up Lindsay Capps and Salam Noor. Welcome, gentlemen.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, I am Lindsay Capps, Acting Chief Education Officer and Education Policy Advisor to Governor Brown. It's good to see everyone again. I was here Friday. Nice to be here again on Monday. Dr. Noor and I are here to provide an update on the work as it pertains to the new federal education law, the Every Student Succeeds Act. And before Dr. Noor provides, I think, some context in terms of how our state will proceed in developing a plan in accordance with the new law and some of the process required of that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some sort of key principles as we're thinking about the work going forward, especially from the perspective of the governor. The signing of the bipartisan Every Student Succeeds Act puts leadership for our students and their future firmly in our hands as Oregonians. It does that by devolving significant authority to the states and to all states to design our system of accountability and the tools we use to measure and report student progress along with school and educator quality. And I'll talk a little bit about that today. But it's important to keep in mind that at the heart of our work is learning. And that is our focus. Every Oregon student ought to see the critical link between their education and their future. Learning should engage, inspire, and empower, and importantly, empower students. And under the ESSA law, the stage is set for schools and families and communities to work together to deepen the connection with students, to broaden their learning experiences, to foster through teaching and learning their critical thinking skills and creativity, and ensure that they have the critical supports they need at every step of the way as they transition and progress through their learning. We have an opportunity through ESSA to build a plan for Oregon that stems from a shared vision for learning, opportunity, and achievement for every student, and includes the flexibility for schools and communities to pursue differentiated strategies to achieve this vision. It's important to be very clear that the new federal law reaffirms Oregon's commitment to high standards. And we are already asking students to reach higher, and they are exceeding our expectations in meeting those standards. But if we are to serve all of our students well, we have to do more than just ensure their proficiency to standards or making sure that they're getting through high school. We need to look at high school graduation as not just a finish line, but a launch pad. And so our vision is that every student graduate high school with a plan for their future, whether college or career, and that the work leading up to that critical transition point is supporting that goal. And this means creating learning opportunities that empower students to take ownership in their learning and building seamless connections from our classrooms to the real world. We see this emphasis in the new federal education law with a focus around CTE and STEAM, as we talked about on Friday. And this is a prime example of a kind of learning that awakens students to the power of their own potential and puts them on a path to future success. So how we think about creating learning opportunities like that is going to be very important. In a moment, Dr. Knorr will outline the focus and process for developing the state plan, and let me just talk quickly about four key areas that I think align with our shared leadership as a state, both the governor and the legislature, and which we're already undertaking action thus far. The first is around equity. And at the core of our work is, as is at the core of many educators' work across the state, is equity. And we must be thoughtful and deliberate and aggressive in addressing persistent gaps in achievement and in opportunity for those students. ESSA maintains a focus on reporting disaggregated data across student populations to inform, evaluate, and assess culturally and regionally specific solutions to support students who need it most. It also reaffirms our commitment through flexibility to working alongside Oregon communities to develop community and culturally specific solutions to improve access and greater opportunity for our students of color and our students navigating poverty. Our commitment to equity begins with, we believe, providing a healthy start and solid early learning foundation for every child in the most critical years of their development, those years 0 to 5. And in Oregon, we've already set our sights on ensuring that every student comes to kindergarten ready to learn and is reading proficiently by third grade. We've expanded options for affordable, high-quality preschool to Oregon families with the new Preschool Promise program serving an additional 1,200 more students across the state or children across the state. We also see a critical linkage in the prioritization that the ESSA provides around high-quality preschool, as well as the additional authorization in the bill for Title I funding. And Congress has authorized an additional $1.2 billion to go to Title I. We'll have to see how that's followed through on within the federal budget, but there is a commitment there. And in so doing, we have the opportunity to leverage our efforts to date to expand regional coordination, quality, and access to preschool to reach more high-need students going forward. Title I funds can also be used for both early childhood programs in schools and for supplemental supports for early literacy, such as after-school and summer learning programs for the highest-need students. The expansion of Title I under ESSA also has the potential to support system-wide equity strategies currently taking shape under the leadership of the governor and legislature, notably the $12.5 million dedicated by the legislature in 2015 to implement policies and practices to improve instruction and outcomes for English language learners. And we have the opportunity, and you'll hear a little bit more this afternoon on this front, to leverage this and other statewide strategies, including the African American Student Success Plan that was put in motion by House Bill 2016. ESSA also provides grants to support local development of programs for tribal students with 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. These resources are critical to augmenting the work underway through our American Indian Alaska Native State Plan and initiatives to curb high chronic absenteeism rates in our tribal communities. Our commitment to high standards, equity, and high school graduation also requires us to consider leadership and innovation that will most effectively foster excellent teaching in Oregon schools. As I mentioned earlier, ESSA provides more flexibility at the local level for school and communities to implement evidence-based strategies, interventions, and practices focused on improved learning outcomes for students and for ongoing continuous improvement in our schools. The governor has additionally identified as a key priority for her the naming of an education innovation officer to better link schools, communities, and communities to practices and strategies that work, and to inform state and local policy and budget priorities and meaningful measures of accountability. So there'll be a critical linkage between that position and the work to develop a state plan. The second area I want to cover is accountability. Just as ESSA continues a focus on high standards, it also establishes parameters for our accountability system and gives us flexibility to design a system that best meets the needs of Oregon students. It provides us the flexibility to work with local stakeholders to determine how educators should be evaluated and supported each year. Of course, through our waiver process, we have laid some important groundwork to consider what an Oregon system of an accountability should should look like. But I want to point out that with this new law, we have the opportunity to shape how we approach accountability such that we create high standards of achievement and also look at other non-academic factors that have an impact on school quality and on student performance. The third area we have to look at is educator effectiveness. ESSA will provide resources to support effective teachers, including high-quality programs for new educators, professional development through Title IIA funds, and to recruit new educators into the profession. These resources provide additional streams of support to existing initiatives that the legislature is currently funding through the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, and importantly, will serve to support our state goals to recruit and retain more educators who reflect the faces and experiences of our students. Fourth and lastly is assessment. ESSA provides Oregon the flexibility to develop a system of assessment that most effectively improves student outcomes. In fact, it encourages the review and elimination of unnecessary tests. Through the leadership of our prior chief education officer and that of educators across the state, Oregon began a process last year to imagine a more balanced system of assessment, a system that moved away from an overemphasis on summative assessment and incorporated more formative and interim assessments tied to the learning environments in which children are learning every day. We are committed to this work moving forward and believe it holds tremendous potential for our students and educators. In closing, there's a lot to be encouraged about in the new law and a lot of responsibility that we all now share and must follow through on. We look forward to working together with the legislature to leverage this opportunity to improve outcomes for students. And I'll now turn it over to Dr. Noor to talk more specifically about the timeline and key activities to develop a plan for Oregon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction with the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm delighted to appear before you today. Lindsay did a wonderful job highlighting some of the key components and the key elements of the new legislation, but I would like to take an opportunity to walk you through the PowerPoint, and I don't know if you have a copy of it in front of you or not, but I'm going to try and get through it as quickly as I possibly can, because I'm really interested in your feedback and your thoughts and perspective on this work that's before us. Let me just click here and see. So I'm going to skip the background and jump into a couple of key elements that I want to underscore. Lindsay talked about the philosophical underpinnings of approaching this with the governor's office, and we take those very seriously, and we've incorporated many of those elements into our thinking. So as the department thinks about developing our state plan, and as we think about engaging partners and stakeholders throughout the state, we have the following commitments in mind. And if you don't mind, I'd like to read them very quickly, and then I'll jump into the presentation. So we're committed to a plan that will improve both teaching and learning and student achievement in our state. We're committed to improve student outcomes, particularly boosting graduation rates for all students. Committed to closing the state's achievement and opportunity gaps and having a state plan focused on educational equity. We're committed to a high-quality instruction and educational leadership. We're committed that every student will be taught by an excellent teacher and every school will be led by a strong educational leader. And lastly, we're committed to school improvement and transforming schools in need of improvement. So we're really excited about this opportunity that's been afforded to us as a state and many states around the country, of course. And we see this as an opportunity to engage Oregonians in a different conversation. For the past 15 years or so, our conversation has been about No Child Left Behind. In fact, the entire Oregon education system has been framed by the conditions and the principles of No Child Left Behind. And it's not to suggest that that is wrong or that is or to dismiss the many wonderful things that we've gleaned and implemented from No Child Left Behind, but we see this as an opportunity to engage Oregonians, educators in particular, and communities throughout the state about the type of education system that they want to have for kids. And then we think about how we leverage the legislation, how we leverage Every Student Succeeds Act to accomplish those goals and objectives and those hopes and dreams that we have for every student in every school and community in our state. So when I look at these highlights, They're going to be similar to what we currently have. We have to maintain assessments. We have to be careful about how we use our funds. We have to think about how we design school improvement and accountability systems. The flexibility that's been afforded to us is really something that we're going to take advantage of, and we're going to engage Oregonians to determine how we actually do that. But what's important here is that it's a culture shift. It's a huge culture shift at the state level, mm-hmm. and it's a culture shift at the local level. And we're encouraging educators to engage in this conversation, to start asking themselves and their communities, what type of an education system do you want to have in the state, and how do we leverage this opportunity to achieve that? So I'm going to run through these fairly quickly. So Lindsay alluded to the standards that we are required to maintain. And excuse me here. I'm going to try and change slides and flip pages at the same time and talk at the same time. Okay,
well, so, three things at one time.
Yes. So the ESSA still requires states to maintain challenging academic standards in reading, math, and science. Our approach is to engage in a conversation with educators and communities about having challenging academic standards in every content area, about affording students the opportunity to access instruction in every content area. And it's not just about math, reading, and science. It's about arts, it's about music, it's about social studies, and lots of other disciplines that kids benefit from learning from. So we're moving from a narrowing of the curriculum to an expanding of the curriculum and a conversation about what do we want that curriculum to look like, what do we want teaching and learning to actually look like in our schools. The other requirement under standards is that our standards and expectations for students in K-12 have to be aligned with post-secondary expectations and workplace expectations. So it affords us an opportunity to work with colleges and universities and the workforce, the workforce sector, to align the learning that students are engaged in with the expectations of colleges, universities, and workforce. We're excited about that. We have a tradition in Oregon. We have a history of working collaboratively across sectors and with workforce, so that's not going to be a stretch for us. On assessments, it requires testing in math and reading in grades 3 through 8 and once in high school, and also requires testing in science at every grade level, once in elementary, once in middle, and once in high school. What's really important here is that we're broadening the definition of assessment. And actually, the conversation now needs to be about assessment for learning and not just assessment for accountability. So when we talk about assessment today, we think about that test that students take at the end of the school year, and we determine the school quality and the effectiveness of the teachers based on that assessment. That is an important data point to have. However, under ESSA, we have the opportunity to broaden our definition of assessment and to include other categories that I will share with you here briefly. Some of the flexibility that we've been afforded pertains specifically to the high school assessment. So in addition to maintaining a state assessment such as SBAC, the Smarter Balance Assessment Test, we have the option to develop a process through which districts can choose a different assessment. So we may consider ACT, SAT, and I just want to assure you that we're going to take advantage of the flexibility that has been afforded to us. We're going to explore all of those options mm-hmm. and work with districts and communities throughout the state.
Is this going to be the idea that everyone in the state has to do the same test, or is that going to be decided by the locals?
Yeah. Chair Doherty, I'm so delighted that you asked that question, because I didn't really want to bore you with the technical details. So we're going to go through a process to determine the best course of action. Mm-hmm. And through this work group process that we have developed, we may come up with a set of recommendations to actually have either a single assessment or multiple assessments, mm-hmm. to have the state choose the assessment or leave it up to the locals to determine which assessment to pursue. However, this is a lot more complicated than it appears. It's not just a matter of selecting an assessment and making it available to districts. We have to think about the quality of the assessment. Whatever assessment we choose has to be aligned to the content standards that are being taught in our classrooms. The assessment has to go through what's called peer review, which is a process at the national level. And if the peer review determines that this is a quality assessment that meets all of the technical requirements, then we can adopt it. So it's not as simple as saying we're going to go with SAT or ACT or gas back. The other thing that we've had some conversations about internally is managing multiple contracts. So do you manage a single contract at the state level? Do you manage multiple contracts with different vendors? Do the local schools manage those contracts with those vendors? So we have to go through this whole process to really work through some of these questions. And our commitment is to take advantage of the flexibility, to have an assessment system that really gives us the right information about our schools, a system that adds value to the student, to their parent, to their school, and to the post-secondary provider should they go directly to a college or university, and hopefully an assessment that has some linkages to the workforce as well. So I hope that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank Flexibility you. Is the key.
Absolutely. Flexibility is the key, and we intend to take advantage of it.
Okay.
When we get through all of this, right now you can kind of compare how one district performs compared to another. Would you expect when we get through with the new improved process here that we'd be able to do that as well or not?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, I think that is the question that we have to keep in the mix here, is the comparability of the data. So if the state is administering one assessment, then it's a lot easier to compare data across schools and districts. If we have multiple assessments, we just have to ensure the comparability, the quality, and the validity of the data. And this is happening at a national level. There are many states that have moved down the path of SAT and ACT, and that's really beneficial to us because they're going to go through peer review this year. And if the U.S. Department of Education comes back and says, yes, your assessment is aligned, this test is aligned to the content standards, it meets that sufficiency from a technical point of view, then it makes it easier for us to choose. And then we have to decide how many. And I would love to get your thoughts on that. I mean, do we have one? Do we have three? Mm-hmm. But those are the technical components that we have to discuss.
Okay. Brief follow-up.
Brief.
So, I think it's important that we align our values before we make that decision. And so one of the values I've seen of the previous testing systems is that we were able to identify where to apply our resources, our limited resources, to different groups of the student population. So I hope that that's a value that we can maintain as we go forward, whichever test we decide to use. But I think that's so important that we don't leave out any subgroup.
Right. Yeah, Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, you're absolutely correct. And this will start as a values conversation. In fact, I'm meeting with about 125 superintendents on Friday, and we're going to talk about assessment. We're going to talk about testing. And we are going to start with a values conversation about what should the assessment actually be for? What's the purpose of the assessment? How do we intend to use the information? Does it add value to the student? Does it add value to the parent, to the school, to the receiving institution, and the workforce? It does need to be initially as a values conversation. Absolutely.
So it's refreshing to have an assessment with a purpose.
Yes.
So anyway, Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. As it relates to the choosing of the national recognized assessment, my concern would be, having been in districts that are trying to implement the assessments, there is a lot of cost related to the district and training folks to be able to even administer these assessments. So if a district can choose an assessment and then they don't like it and then they choose another one, I'm interested in what your plan is in regards to the cost of what this will be.
Yes,
for the assessment and for the implementation of.
Absolutely. Chair Doherty, Representative Hack, I think those are the questions that our work group on assessment, on standards and assessments, will be grappling with. Can we afford to have multiple assessments, first of all? So you start from a values point of view. Can we afford to have multiple assessments? If we do have multiple assessments, do they all meet the values that we've identified for ourselves? Mm-hmm. Should districts not like an assessment, do they have the option to choose a different assessment the following year? Does that do anything to the information that we need to have on students and their performance? So we are approaching this with a great deal of care. We appreciate the flexibility that's been afforded to us, and we're going to be extremely thoughtful in terms of what system we design to accommodate this. We have districts in the state that prefer to go with ACT. compared to any other assessment. There is an equity component to this. The cost is one. So we have to look at the resources that have been allocated to us from you and from the federal government to maintain a quality balanced assessment system, and what can we afford. So it's fairly complicated. We're happy to have the flexibility, and we're going to look at all of those technical details and then make a recommendation essentially to the state board and the governor about the best assessment system and modality to adopt.
So it's just very early in the process.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Okay.
And
thank
we will keep you posted. We will
thank
be
you.
Happy to come back and update you on our conversations, the key decision points, and where we're headed.
That's great. Okay. Sorry.
Excellent. So 95 participation is still a requirement for all students and subgroups.
We have one more question.
Excuse me.
You know, I might save that question for the end of the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So the 95% participation is a requirement of all students. The change here from NCLB is that the 95% participation now also applies to every single subgroup in the school. The state can create an opt-out policy. We have one. And the states can decide how to weigh the participation rate in the accountability system. And I'm going to talk about the accountability system here shortly. So under accountability, if you recall, under NCLB, schools were essentially labeled as, you know, meeting AYP or not meeting AYP, and that can be interpreted in a variety of ways. So this legislation actually eliminates AYP and replaces AYP with a much broader system of accountability, and we're extremely excited about that.
Yeah.
Under the current system, accountability is based almost exclusively on the state test and the student's performance on the state test. Under this system of accountability, we have an indexed system that has required components and other components that can be identified by the state. So under academic achievement, we still have the achievement on state test. We have growth. We're a state that's very committed to growth because we need to measure student progress over a three-year period and not just a fixed point in time. The other academic indicator is English language proficiency for English language learners and graduation rates for high school. We as a state have now the opportunity to identify what's called school quality and student success indicators, and we're going to engage the field to identify those indicators. So, for example, student engagement could be an indicator. We have to decide how we define that and measure it. Access to advanced coursework, access to CTE programs and courses, school climate, the number of CTE programs that the student has, the number of AP programs and opportunities that students are afforded in the school, the number of nationally recognized or nationally certified teachers, the number of counselors, the number of college credits that a student can actually earn while they're in high school. So all of those are potentially indicators of school quality and student success that we will identify as a state. We may need to determine if there is a core set that apply to all schools, and that's, again, the equity piece that Lindsay referenced, and maybe a menu of other indicators that schools and districts can choose to identify and select from to celebrate and recognize the work that they're doing. What's important here is that we have an expanded definition of accountability. This is a wonderful opportunity that we've been afforded, and it really causes us to ask the question, what are some of the attributes of a quality school? Right now, the attribute of a quality school is the student's performance on the assessment, but we know there's a lot more that's happening in that school that is a pride point and something that is benefiting students and the community. So this is where accountability has been expanded, and we're very excited about that. Again, we have to determine the weights. So the academic indicators cannot be less than 50%. So we know that's going to be about 50 to 51% of the accountability framework. And then we have to decide how we treat the participation. So that's also factored into our flexibility on assessment. So that, those things are linked. So, but we have to decide how to treat the 95 participation requirement and how that is part of the accountability system. And then there is something that's unique to ESSA that was not necessarily in NCLB, and that is a differentiated model of accountability and school improvement. So we still have to identify schools that are currently identified as focus and priority schools. We have to do that every 3 years. And those schools are typically the ones that are in the lowest performing category of Title I schools, 5%. High schools that have a graduation rate of 67% or less can now be eligible to receive supports and interventions from the state. And that's a new opportunity that's been afforded to us here. The positive about this is that schools that are not Title I. So if you're a high school and you're not a Title I high school, but you've been identified as in need of improvement because your graduation rate is lower than 67%, you can now access Title I resources. You can access federal resources to help make progress in that area. The state is responsible for identifying those schools and working with the district to develop plans to improve those schools. The new category is the second bullet on the bottom, that states must annually notify districts when one or more subgroups of students are consistently underperforming. So we have accountability for schools and districts, but this is new accountability for subgroups. So as we monitor our data on an annual basis and we notice, let's say, that the ELL group in a particular school is persistently underperforming, we have a responsibility to notify the district. However, the accountability is on the district. So the district has to work with that school to help improve the performance of that subgroup. And it's really interesting because it creates a shared partnership and a shared responsibility between the state and the district for the improvement of all schools and subgroups. Again, it's a differentiated model. The report card, let's see, I think I skipped a page, but that's okay. I think this is the most important, more important. So the report card remains in place, and we're really treating the report card as the new accountability framework, because it will be more inclusive of many of indicators that are significant to the school and that community. And it will provide a lot of information, more than what our current report card does. So we're treating the report card as the new accountability framework, if you will, to broaden the conversation. So it's not about a single test. It's about how does the test relate to many other variables in the school that are helping students succeed. Lindy alluded to the teacher quality and evaluation flexibility that's been afforded to us. The highly qualified definition is no longer required. However, we have to meet the standards that have been established in our state laws for teacher licensure and certification. And there are some special education requirements that we have to transition into the new system.
That was a good move. That was a good move to get
We're
rid
all
of
applauding.
That.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. And also against the federal mandate on educator evaluation. I just want to underscore the good work that we have done relative to educator evaluation in our state and how that work is facilitating collaboration between teachers and administrators. And it's in law. Senate Bill 290 preserved the framework for teacher and administrator evaluation in the state of Oregon. So our plan is to take advantage of this flexibility, but to engage stakeholders, to engage the architects of the framework that we currently have in moving towards this new system that we will have. So I think we will have an opportunity to talk with practitioners. We'll have an opportunity to learn from the work that we've done over the last 3 or 4 years and make some tweaks and adjustments to address this issue over here. Again, it'll be a committee process, an inclusive process. Oops, I'm clicking just way too fast here. Here we go. 21st century schools. I am really most excited about the opportunities that we've been afforded under Title IV, which is 21st century schools and many other programs. Title IV, unlike NCLB, talks about a well-rounded educational system, talks about well-rounded educational opportunities for students, and it provides examples such as advanced placement, international baccalaureate, test fee reimbursement for students that are income eligible to participate in the assessments and the tests for IB and AP, STEM programs, music and arts, computer science, CTE, and others. It also requires attention to a safe and healthy schools environment and the effective use of technology. So we are very encouraged by the new language and this framework that we've been afforded to think differently about the way we use those resources. And I'm envisioning a redesign, quite honestly, of how we do 21st century community learning grants to be inclusive of those opportunities that will incentivize other opportunities in our system. Lindsay talked about the early learning component of ESSA, and that is exciting because it will allow for further alignment between preschool, early learning, and K-12 and post-secondary education. And Lindsay touched on programs for English language learners, Indian education, and homeless education that are very clearly spelled out and will need to be part of the report card. These were not included in the report card in the past. So for us, the plan is to take advantage of this flexibility that we've been afforded to develop a process that will engage educators, all educators, community members, business partners, stakeholders, community-based organizations, anyone that wants to participate in a process that gets us to the best plan we could possibly have for the state of Oregon. So timeline-wise, the waiver that we're currently under will expire July 1, 2016. Although ESSA will take effect, August 1, 2016 is when our waiver will expire. So technically, ESSA will take effect August 1, 2016. However, the accountability system does not take effect until 17-18, and that's good because it gives us time to do some planning and field engagement. We have an interesting situation between existing programs and new programs that will be coming online in 2016, and that is the funding source. So we still have programs that were funded by the omnibus bill that was passed in December, I believe. It's new funding, but it still applies to existing programs. Mm-hmm. And then we will have new funding in August 2016 that applies to future programs. So we're navigating that and managing all of this. I think one of the challenges is that as we think about all of these opportunities and as we think about designing the plan and the implementation of the plan, we have to await U.S. Department of Education guidance on it and regulations. And those regulations will not be finished until October of 2016. So we just have to kind of navigate that to the best of our abilities, and we're in constant contact with our partners at the federal level to learn about the direction that they are headed. So our rollout plan, January, we have an internal group at the department, a cross-office group that's working on developing the rollout and implementation plan. We plan to convene stakeholders into four work groups: standards and assessment, accountability, school improvement, and educator effectiveness. We will have a fifth group that I'm calling an advisory committee that essentially will be the litmus test. So these groups are going to go do their work. They'll come up with their recommendations. The recommendations will come to the advisory committee that will be comprised primarily of practitioners, and then the advisory committee will give it the thumbs up to say, yes, we can do this, this is reasonable. Or they may say, you know, we need to rethink this, or this is not feasible within our current system, and it can go back to the work group. Our plan is to have a draft consolidated plan by May, June, and to engage the field again between during that time frame to get additional feedback and to have a draft ready to go by August 2016. So I won't bore you with this, but this is also our thinking relative to the implementation. So 16-17 is a transition year. 17-18 is an actual implementation year. And that's where we stop. So the last thing that I want to highlight, and it's something that Lindsay touched on, and our partners at the federal level have spoken to it very specifically every time we've had an opportunity to engage them, is that the equity component and the civil rights component of this bill, of this law, is integral to everything that we do. ESEA was established in 1965, and it was born out of the civil rights movement. So although a great deal of flexibility has been afforded to states, we can't forget and lose sight of our responsibility to students that are intended to be served by those funds. And those funds will be leveraged to increase the resources and to increase the supports that schools and districts provide to students that we know are in need of additional supports and resources. So the equity piece is really integral to this, and we can't forget that, and we can't afford to lose our focus on that as we move forward and take advantage of this flexibility that's been afforded to us. Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity, and I'll welcome any questions you and the committee may have.
Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Neuer, by the way, you came out of the Salem-Keizer district, didn't you?
Yeah.
I don't live anywhere close to here, but I've had an opportunity through grandchildren to get familiar with Myers School and Walker and West, and I live in the North Salem district, and attended a wonderful event there the other night and blessed with good schools. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a question. When I was here last time, No Child Left Behind was brand new, mm-hmm. and everybody was excited about it and buzzed up about it. Education Committee, we sat through a lot of discussions about that. I wanted to ask you, what is the greatest thing that we learned in looking back, or soon to look back, on No Child Left Behind? When we look back on that, what's probably the biggest takeaway for you? Because I know you've had a long time to see programs come and go.
Right.
And so the question about No Child Left Behind, yeah. What are you glad to leave behind with that?
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, thank you for the question, and I totally concur with you about the schools in the Salem-Keizer school districts, and the ones that you mentioned actually are ones that my kids have gone to and are still in, so thank you for that. I think we learned a great deal from No Child Left Behind. There has been some really positive developments as a result of No Child Left Behind. So the accountability for every student, the data that we collect to make sure that every student is learning, the monitoring of progress of every student groups, and how we compare that to the rest of the student population. So there has been some really positive things that we learned from No Child Left Behind. I would say the biggest takeaway, and I think this is the opportunity that's been afforded to us under ESSA, is to bring things back into balance. So under NCLB became our state education system. So when I think about the amount of funding that the state puts into education, and let's take the last biennium, I think it's about $7.25 billion. And when you add the local funding that goes into it, I'm sure it's in excess of $10, $11, maybe $12 billion. I don't know. But when we look at the funding that we receive from the federal government, it's a fraction of that. But we've let NCLB define everything that we do in schools today. And I think as educational leaders and as legislators, we have a responsibility to pause back and think about what is the education system that we want to have, mm-hmm. and then let's leverage those resources to achieve that. So they're intended to be supplemental and not to supplant. However, financially, we've met that obligation. We've maintained the supplemental clause that's required by the federal government, but in terms of the law itself and the system that it created, it really supplanted our education system. So I want to engage my teachers relative to my kids, and all I want to know is, are they learning? Are they growing? Are they where they're supposed to be? Does their teacher care about them? Are they in a safe environment? Are they taking an assessment that's going to tell me something about their learning and it's going to be of value to their teacher and their schools? Are they going to graduate on time? And are they going to be prepared to go to the workforce or a college, community college or university? And I think we've moved away from that type of conversation to focus exclusively on the test and whether students took the test or not and whether they passed the test or not. So the takeaway is that this is an opportunity to swing things back into balance, to have that conversation, and to remember the type of education system that we want to have, first and foremost. Mm-hmm.
Just one quick follow-up, if I might. You've mentioned flexibility as one of the strong suits of ESSA here. Flexibility from the feds is kind of a new concept for me, coming from down south. Wanted to ask you, that apparently is an outstanding feature as far as you're concerned, and do you expect to be able to get the most out of that over time?
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, absolutely. We intend to get the most out of it. We intend to explore every option possible and every possibility that has been afforded to us. And it is unusual. Mm-hmm. And as a result, it puts tremendous burden on the states. So we've been given flexibility, but that comes with tremendous responsibility. Now we assume that responsibility for each and every single student, which I know we do. But I think that's that's the question here is we've been afforded flexibility. I want to make sure that we succeed in the eyes of the feds in terms of how we take advantage of this flexibility and the type of system that we afford our students, and that we're able to essentially hold our end of the bargain.
So, best of luck.
Thank you.
Questions? Representative McLean.
Mine's really not a question. It's more of a comment. But I just wanted to tell you both that I really appreciated the comments that you made today on the structure and the basic foundational values of what we have in the way of an opportunity in the ESSA. What you said, Dr. Noor, though, the last part to the answer to Representative Wilson's question to me was the most important, because you got back to the relationship between parents, students, and the classroom. And that's what I have felt has been missing with No Child Left Behind, because we became bookkeepers. Yeah. We became data collectors. We look for the simplest data. And there, you know, when you're dealing with human beings and students in a classroom, nothing is simple. And it shouldn't be. And the whole idea of creativity and all kinds of critical thinking being the basis of good learning and the values of learning, and all of those things are so important. The one thing that I am hoping with your, what you described as your check group, the group that's going to be practitioners that are going to really look at what you are trying to achieve and say, is this really something new, and is it doing what you want it to, and what we need to be able to be successful in the classroom. That's where I want us to put the energy. Yes, we have to be accountable. We all know that. We want to make sure that we can meet any standard. Used to be a waiver, now it'll be our own program. But we've got to make sure that we're concentrating on the classroom, not just, again, performing better for another report. Right. And so get it back to the kids and get it back to the parents, the families, and the reasons that we're in the classroom in the first place, or online in our virtual schools, because I support all virtual schools that are doing a good job as well. But I really appreciate what you had to say, and I hope you'll involve us more and keep us updated on all of this.
Thank you. Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Frederick.
Thank you. And I apologize for not being here, but I think I've heard this presentation before. And I wanted to just echo something that I've said before. And I appreciate what Representative McLean and Wilson have both spoken about. I want to get us to a point where we're talking about kids enjoying going to school. I mean, I know it sounds like something perhaps impossible, but I think it is possible. And we have put barriers to that, and I think the barriers that we saw with NCLB and some of the other concerns stopped folks from being there. I don't think it's a surprise that we had the high dropout rate during the time we were dealing with NCLB. I don't think that should be a surprise for anyone, or lack of completion, a low completion rate. If we can find a way to encourage and support the students, the teachers, the parents, the schools, in a way that we actually have a good time with education, that's what I'm looking for. So thank you.
Make it fun again. Okay, any other comments? I just have a couple of comments. First of all, I made kind of a sneering at the highly qualified. And people say, well, everyone should be highly qualified. And what literally it was an additional teaching license. And some of the best reading teachers in the world are first, second, third grade teachers, yet they may not have a reading endorsement. And so they were not considered highly qualified. And yep. So, you know, those are the sort of things that I think one of the barriers that to teachers on something like this. Great educators knew exactly what they were doing, but they didn't have that piece of paper that said, I'm now licensed in XYZ. So I was glad to see that. Glad to see all stakeholders in. Yes. And I kind of echo what Representative Frederick said, because I think teaching used to be a lot more fun than it is now. And I think part of it is because of all the requirements and teaching to the test and so on. So we'd like to see that. But anyway, I'm glad to see all of this. And especially one emphasis and coming from me is the idea of educational leaders. The best schools I ever dealt with were the ones that had the best principals, and that they had been good educators, and that they had been trained in leadership, and they were given the opportunity to be able to work with educators in their own buildings and work with the kids and be out there. And so I hope I see more of that, educational leadership.
Absolutely.
Okay, yep. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank
we're anxious
you.
To hear from you again. Thank you. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing on ESSA, and then also, I've just closed it, but also, there's testimony from Representative Bonamici, also in the OLIS system, so it's there. Okay, and then with that, I open up an informational hearing on House Bill 2016, kind of appropriate, 2016. So I have Markeisha Smith, Cindy Hunt, and whoever else wants to come on up.
I'm Cindy Hunt, the Government and Legal Affairs Manager for the Oregon Department of Education, and with me today
is Dr. Markeisha Smith, and I am the Director of the Oregon Department of Education Equity Unit.
Great. So we're going to switch from federal law to state law. So last session, you all passed House Bill 2016, which directed the department to work on a plan for African American students. The bill also directed us to form a work group, and it also told us to bring you a progress report on how much progress we've made last fall. We filed that and gave each of you a copy right around January 1st. So, but if you need additional copies, we're happy to send those over. The bill also appropriated some money for this work, but told us, hey, wait, don't spend it until like April 1st. And that was so that we didn't get ahead of the work and ahead of the work of the work group. But with that, Dr. Smith is going to take you through the recommendations out of the work group and more details.
Okay. Again, good afternoon, Chair Daugherty and members of the committee. My name is Markeisha Smith, for the record. And as we've mentioned, I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Education Equity Unit. And this is basically just some information and update on what has been happening since January 1st. The report that you all received is sort of our interim progress report. And with that, kind of jumping to our slides here. All right, so just some very quick background here. The House bill directed us to basically do two things. And the first is to develop and implement the statewide plan of education for African American and Black students in our state, looking at those students from early childhood through post-secondary education. And the second directive was that we convene an advisory group to really guide that work and to suggest recommendations for what the plan would become. And so that's where we are at this point. So this language in the next couple of slides comes directly from the bill itself, and you'll see highlighted some of the project success measures, and these also really emphasize the conversations that have been happening as a part of the advisory group convenings. And so you'll see, and I won't read all this to you, but there have been conversations around discipline and parental engagement, looking at transitions for students to middle school and through high school and on to post-secondary education, early childhood. So those are sort of the places where we've been spending a lot of our time in conversation during the work groups. And continuing on, we're also looking at what it means to be culturally responsive in terms of pedagogy and practice. So we've had conversations about that. And then in addition to that, attendance. And so really thinking about what that looks like at the post-secondary level as well for students in the system. All right, so just to give some quick highlights on what's been happening and what we're calling year one. So we have our chair, co-chairs appointed, Joyce Harris and Charles McGee, who have been instrumental in helping lead the charge on this work. I'll give you a little bit of information there just around who is a part of the advisory group. And so we have 32 members representing our body, and they represent P20 Education, and we have a variety of different entities that are represented there that are making recommendations. And that's the wonderful thing about this group, because they're coming from very different perspectives and are able to offer that. We've been able to really be open and be collaborative in nature during the process of our meetings. And we started meeting in October, and unfortunately I had to exit for a little while and then re-enter. I went away, had a baby, came back. So
pictures.
Yeah. Don't have any in the slide presentation.
Oh, darn. Oh.
I know. But if you want to see them, they're on my phone. So I was not able to be at the first meeting, but I did rejoin by phone in December and have been in the loop the entire time, and was really happy to be back in person in January. And I will say things have been going extremely well, conversations going extremely well. I think that was well represented in the report, the interim report that we shared with you all on just really how that everything is progressing. And one of the other points to mention, because this will come up here in the next few slides, is just the work around the resource teams. Americans, and so we felt it important to really get the voice, P20, that we have individuals that had expertise in particular areas have those conversations. And so we have these resource teams that have been meeting offline, right, in terms of not at our actual advisory meetings all the time. We get into groups sometimes there. We're having conversations in resource teams away from the monthly meetings and really pulling all this information together. So a little bit more about what else has happened in year one. We have this draft operational framework that our community members came up with, and the resource teams are in the process of really identifying the goals and identifying the recommendations based on those goals for the plan itself. We adopted our project charter. We had the progress report that I mentioned to you all that you know about. And we are now in the process of really looking at the funding proposal. So we've and you'll see here in a moment, have been working on the draft for what the plan will look like, and also having some conversations around funding and what that will look like. As Cindy mentioned, April will be the time frame that we're looking at to award grants related to this House bill. I just can't connect technology today. All right, so the plan draft. So we'll just start with higher ed and kind of work our way down. So this gives you an idea of the sort of just high-level conversations that have been happening within the resource teams. And so higher education has been really focusing on completion, right? So the completion at 2- and 4-year institutions, and then retention. So their conversations are really focused on those two big topics. And then within that, there are definitely more details. But that just sort of gives you a sense of what their contribution to the plan would look like, and these will be the points that they're focused on. So in 9-12, so looking at high school level, resource teams have been talking about attendance again, so making sure that students are in school and are getting the academic preparation that they need in order to go on to whatever it may be that's the next step for them, college and career success. And then also looking at high school graduation rates, and we know that is definitely echoing what is happening around the state and not just with this plan, but what we're talking about at the department level as well. So it aligns very nicely with our goals internally as well. Hey, looking at grade 4 to middle school. So they have been focusing again on the attendance rates for African American and Black students in school, and then also this conversation around family engagement opportunities and making sure that that is culturally responsive in nature. Mm-hmm. It's not just a matter of inviting parents to you know, come in for a PTA meeting. I'll use that as an example, but really, what does meaningful engagement look like, and how do they have a voice in what happens in their students' lives? And so this has been a conversation that has been happening with our grade 4 to middle school transitions team. And then the early childhood education, and we had kind of a combination here, and we sent over an update just to make sure that we separated these out. So our K-3 resource team has been talking a lot about addressing recruitment, hiring, and retention of African-American and Black teachers, and that, again, is very in line with a lot of the work, and Representative Frederick knows the work that we've been doing with our educator equity group, and so looking at that recruitment and retention piece. And the same would, make sense here for administrators, so looking at ways that we not only have teachers in the classroom that reflect our students, but also administrators, and how we can make sure that those opportunities for advancement are in place. And so they've been spending some time speaking of that. And then the early childhood resource team has really been talking about early childhood readiness for kindergarten, and that conversation is ongoing, and the culturally responsive pedagogy curriculum and investments. So again, you'll hear that word culturally responsive come up quite often in this work. And then finally, the increase of the percentage of African-American early childhood providers. So again, kind of going back to this idea around recruitment and retention and what that looks like as we're trying to better reflect the population of students in our state. So moving on to the funding proposal. So this is another place where our work has shifted, and we've been in constant conversation about this, and I think we've landed on some places. One of the things we had to balance is a rather short timeline and doing that in a way that would really show results so that we can, you know, best represent what the voice of the community is saying and what we know works. And so we wanted to be very mindful and purposeful about how we went about, you know, thinking about funding, right, and what this would really look like in the next few months. And so this is where we landed. And so I have a couple of slides here that speak to that. So one big area, and I'll kind of call them buckets for lack of a better word right now, but school attendance and chronic absenteeism. So we, if you go think back to the slides I showed just in terms of, you know, what the plan would look like, those are the sorts of things that are coming to the surface when we're thinking about getting students in school, making sure that they have the supports that they need to be successful academically, socially, and otherwise. And so the attention here we think really needs to be you know, funding that really looks at how can we make sure that that happens so that we have that increased attendance across the system. And within that, one of the things that has come up is this idea around disproportionate discipline. And so it's really important for us to think about how that concept and how that reality, I won't even say concept, but how that reality really feeds into conversations around attendance and chronic absenteeism. And so we have to, you know, really think about the numbers when it comes down to suspension and expulsions and how that is a key component sometimes to keeping students of color out of school and the reality that we face when we look at the data and disaggregate that is not necessarily something that you know, we can shy away from. And so we've put some metrics here and linking that back to what we know in the data currently in our school-wide report card and saying, you know, what again can we do on a short amount of time to really see some change there. And so you'll see where we've landed on some metrics around school attendance and chronic absenteeism. So the next area is really looking at addressing parent and community engagement. And this one's a little trickier because at the department, we don't collect data around parent and community engagement, but we know and value its importance and what happens with students from, you know, pre-K through grade 12. We know that it's very important to have the voices of parents in the community at the table and to do that in a meaningful way. And so we're really thinking about the impact that can have on academic achievement and graduation rates for African American and Black students. And for us, it's more around how can we make sure that there's an increase in what that engagement looks like, and again, meaningful engagement. And so that's where we've landed. And again, not a metric that we collect as a department, but one that we know our community is engaged in a variety of ways. And organizations that I've had the privilege of working with over the last 2.5 years that we know are doing this work. And so here we are. another area is really looking at this transition piece, and from middle to high school, and then from high school on into post-secondary. And part of that is really investing in some programs around summer support, particularly for the middle and high school transition, and then thinking about potentially what that also looks like for students who are getting ready to take the next step, right, into college and into whatever career transition there may be. And so we want to keep better track of what's happening in the summer and think about how that can improve what happens not only in that moment, you know, June, July, August, but also how that translates into the regular academic year and the sort of graduation increases, dropout decreases that we're seeing as a result of what's happening with students during summer programming. So we have a metric there as well to increase that enrollment in those summer programs. So kind of shifting gears a little bit. So a little bit about the plan, a little bit about the funding. One of the other really exciting pieces to this, and I think, you know, we speak a lot about community engagement, and so we need to live that, I think, in the work that we're doing. And I'm very pleased to say that with the wonderful leadership of my colleague and partner, Kendra Hughes, who's in the audience with me today. She's been able to organize these wonderful community events and to really share what the plan is about, to share what the thinking is, and to get feedback. That's been very meaningful, I think, in the way that we continue to engage in the work. And so you'll see here dates that we have already passed and things have gone really well. And then we have some future dates that are coming up. The really nice thing about this is that this is across the state. And so we've not just focused on what's happening along the I-5 corridor, but we really thought very carefully about what this means for folks, even in Ontario, which I've never been to. Here, it's a wonderful place. We need to be there. We need to be doing this work. And this also is representative.
Especially in April.
Yeah, in April. Right. I've heard.
Not in January. But in April.
Not in January.
It's also very purposefully seasonally. But you know, the other really great thing about this this list represents who's also serving on our advisory committee. And so we have representatives from, you know, these areas as well. And so that has been instrumental in helping us get into those areas to have these community engagement events. And so it's been nice to have, you know, folks open their doors and say, yes, we'd be more than happy to have you come and really share the work that's happening around House Bill 2016. So I'm thankful to the advisory group and thankful to Kendra for really making sure that this is going forward. So, okay. Questions?
Well, I was going to say, well, before we have questions, we do have our co-chairs,
yes.
Charles McGee
yes.
and Joyce Harris. If they'd like to come up and maybe say a few things about the committee or here to answer questions, or you don't have to come up if you don't want to. And then we'll just open things up to questions, if that's okay with you guys. There you go. And if you want to introduce yourself for the record and if you wanted to say any words before we ask you questions.
My name is Joyce Harris, and I am Community Engagement Manager at Education Northwest, and I'm co-chair of the Advisory Committee.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm Charles McGee, and I'm co-chair as well. First, I want to thank you all for your leadership and for sort of this opportunity. You know, one of the amazing parts about this work, not only is, sort of, as Markeisha mentioned, sort of pulling together this extremely diverse group of folks and representatives from this state, but also the fact that the legislature is sort of leading the way and really saying, you know, it's kind of a proud moment for Oregon to be saying, after years of talking about the achievement gap, that we're actually going to do something, roll up our sleeves. And as a community, as community members, I know we are thrilled to be down this road, and we're certainly pleased to partner with the department on this work.
And what I'd like to say is that I know you all have high expectations of our committee and the department. We also have high expectations that we will meet these goals. And I think Representative Springer asked me earlier, are people excited about this? You're darn right they are.
That's good.
I mean, I can't go out in the store or to an event without someone kind of coming up to me. So tell me about this House Bill thing you're on. And people are hopeful, and we need to really make sure that we keep this train moving. We keep, because for all of us, it's the children.
Yep.
That's the bottom line. And we all are keeping our eyes on the prize, which is keep it centered on what we can do to make education and life better for children in this state. That's it. That's the bottom line.
Right, well, we certainly appreciate your community service for doing this. It's very, very, it's great. Your enthusiasm will be spread. So anyway, questions, Representative Frederick and Representative Hack?
I just wanted to say welcome to my world in terms of the grocery store. So I'm on one aisle, you're on the other one. I know how that is.
We've met sometimes.
All at Safeway.
All at Safeway. Well, Fred Meyer at Safeway.
Fred Meyer.
New seasons every once in a while, too.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention something else, though, and it's something that you brought up, Markeisha. The fact is we have some programs that have worked in the past, mm-hmm. and they have been dismantled over the years. Good programs that have really, really worked in the past. And I know you actually organized some of them, so I remember watching you do that. Yeah. Are we going to, one of the problems that I've seen is that we've spent an awful lot of time looking for the newest silver bullet.
Right.
when in fact we have some things that actually work. Are we going to be able to go back and find out those things and say, let's see if we can actually get those, keep those things going? Because we've in the past we've had a sort of a serial disruption take place that has left a lot of good programs in the back on the ground. Are we going to be able to evaluate those and look at those? Because I know you've seen those programs. You know, you have that list in your head right now, I'm sure.
And I think that many of those programs and the outcomes and the promising practices that came out can also be picked up, because people are talking about that. You know, when I hear people say, well, remember when we used to. And so I'm hoping that as people think about how they're going to apply for these dollars and talk to many of us, you know, what did we do 10 years ago that was, what about that program, you know, that worked? And I think there are all kinds of opportunities, Lou, and I'm always one that says to people, there is no silver bullet. It's a combination of things that we know have worked. I mean, often we're looking for that one thing. Oh, if we just do this, if we just fix this, everything will be okay. And that's not the way that the world works. And so I'm hopeful that we will, you know, reflect back, have people reflect on the things that work. And I think that's why these community forums are also good.
Follow up, if you don't mind. Some of those programs are going to go back to before your fellow co-chair was born. So some of them, and I remember them. That's what's even more disturbing. But
it's all right. He gives me a hard time.
Well, of course. I've known him since he was about 12. So.
For the beard.
But the fact is there are programs that were working 20, 30 years ago, not just
Absolutely.
10. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to try to find out where those are and pick them up again. So thank you. I appreciate
okay.
that.
Thank you so much for the question.
Great. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to say thank you also. We spent some time talking and meeting, and I know you just have such great hearts for this work. So I just wanted to say thank you to all of you for what you're doing, and I look forward to seeing the progress reports come back, exceeding where you're at. I think you've got some lofty goals to meet, and I'm a little nervous about that, but I commend you for that also, because go home or, you know, go big or go home, and that's exactly what you're doing. And so I just wanted to commend you for what you're doing, and thank you for bringing 32 people to the table. I know that in itself is a huge challenge, but I think it's key to the success of what we're trying to do here. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you all, please feel free to stop by our meetings anytime, first Fridays of the month from 9 to 2. If you want to stop in and just meet some incredible people, we've got an incredible advisory board.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much.
Representative Springer.
Thank you. thank you, Madam Chair. That just brings up what I think is a good point. Would you include at least me and probably the rest of the panel on your email list when you send out notices for those meetings?
Yeah. Absolutely. Kendra,
that's a more effective method than telling us what dates they are.
Yes. Yeah. Most definitely.
Yes, the person in charge got that. That's great.
And if you let us know when you're coming, we might be able to arrange for something to eat.
Hey, we'll let you know. and just a couple of comments. I think the transition component that you have between middle school and high school and post is so important, especially from the middle school to high school. Forest Grove has had that for a long time, and it really has done a great job of transitioning kids that actually whose parents never went to high school into that high school situation. And then I hope when the money thing, that there'll be money for personnel, especially when we talk about attendance, when we talk about achievement and this kind of thing, to work with the kids one-on-one, or just because sometimes it just takes that one adult to do that. But I'm very impressed with that and with the engagement, because whatever the town hall thing I was at a couple of weeks ago, I was very impressed with the community engagement in that one. And that was not tied up with your organization, you know, this group. But the will is definitely there. So
Can I just say one thing? I'd like to introduce the coordinator for this work, whose position actually was funded through the bill, and that's Kendra Hughes. She has done a phenomenal job of keeping everybody on track.
That's not an easy job.
And doing the grunt work. Okay. So that's Kendra.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions, comments? Thank you all. We'll keep our fingers crossed, and we are all be looking forward to the progress report. Thank you very much. With that, I close the informational hearing on House Bill 2016. And a couple of announcements. I know this will break your hearts, but we're not meeting Wednesday or Friday.
Oh.
I know. You can come here and sit if you'd like to, but we're not meeting Monday or Friday. And on Monday the 29th, we have a informational hearing with the kids from REAP, and that's the Reaching and Empowering All People. We've had them in before. And so that's the only thing we have scheduled. I don't think we have any more bills coming over from the Senate. So we're done with our official work.
All right.
Okay, anything else? Okay, with that, I adjourn. Okay, anything else? Okay, with that, I adjourn.
All right.